You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
From 1 Crown Office Row and the UK Human Rights Blog, I'm Rosalind English with an introduction to our new series of podcasts. We will be bringing you interviews with our team of writers on the cases and events they cover in their weekly roundups, and you'll also be hearing from members of 1 Crown Office Row on the cases they've been involved with. In this issue, I'll be talking to Sarah Jane Ewart about the events and cases she's covered for her most recent roundup this week. Let's take up the one that you've published this week, starting with what promises to be a media frenzy over the first all-female alleged terror plot in Britain.
In this case, three women, including a mother and a daughter, have been remanded and in custody, charged with conspiracy and engaging in conduct in preparation for terrorist acts. And they're supposed to have been plotting an attempted knife attack at Westminster, and if they're charged, then this will be the UK's first female terror plot. I hope that media frenzy was overstatement on my part, but the press does tend to be feverish over female criminals in general, and I think there was some fascination in some strands of the press with the detail that one of the women was asked by the judge to remove her veil so that her eyes could be seen. I think that that was all that happened, but then that detail was sort of blown up so that elsewhere it was reported that she refused to remove her hijab in court, etc. So, yeah, I would say the case is less interesting on the law so far and more on the cultural context.
Do you think in the light of the fascination with the femaleness of the defendants that there's any chance of them having less than a fair trial?
I would certainly hope not. It is just that the press tends to latch on with those details, and particularly if this is our first female terror plot as well, that's kind of an added edge of fascination.
So moving on to the second item on in your roundup, we're looking at the availability of legal aid for unaccompanied minors in immigration cases. So in 2012, the Legal Aid Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Act, bit of a mouthful, LASBO for short, brought a number of areas of law out of the scope of legal aid, including most immigration matters. Of course, these changes brought in by LASBO also apply to children. Can you tell us something about the research by the Children's Society and the impact of these provisions on unaccompanied migrant children?
Essentially, the Children's Society are asking for contributions from legal practitioners, any legal practitioners who work with unaccompanied migrant children. It's in the form of a survey. The link is in the roundup. And I think that there's some more information over on free movement as well on Colin Yeo's blog. As for what specific challenge the Children's Society might hope to mount, I'm sure they'll tell you themselves if you do want to get involved, but this certainly would not be the first legal challenge against LASBO, probably not the last either. There were a couple of really interesting ones last year, one brought by Rights of Women to challenge the prohibitively high evidence requirements for victims of domestic violence. There's also the Public Law Project challenge to the provision in LASBO which said that anyone who failed a residence test would not get legal aid. And the Supreme Court agreed in that case that this precluded an entire class of people from the right to legal aid on the basis of completely irrelevant personal circumstance, residence, which is wholly unconnected to a person's need for or ability to pay for legal services. And presumably there's more than enough evidence for a similar challenge on behalf of unaccompanied migrant children. I mean, essentially, there are no children-specific provisions in LASBO. And so most cases involve ECF applications or exceptional case funding applications. This is a scheme that was built into the legislation as kind of a safety net, right? Supposedly to filter any cases where a denial of legal aid would violate the right to a fair trial. But there are extensively documented problems with that scheme. For more information, there's a report by the Children's Society in 2015. It's called Cut Off from Justice. And I'd highly recommend it. And there's a little bit in it which really rankles. It highlights a comment by the former Undersecretary of State for Justice. He said that most immigration cases entail a relatively straightforward process. That's how he put it. And that with the help of their guardian, most children would be able to complete the process with recourse to specialist legal advice. basically, this is suggesting that children could seek advice from social workers or pro bono lawyers to help them rather than needing recourse to legal aid. And anyone who works in the sector could tell you why that is at the very least impractical. Giving immigration advice is heavily regulated. I mean, it's illegal unless you're specifically certified to do so, but also because of the closure of many of the centres that could have provided that help. That's even before you start to consider language barriers or accessibility.
So anything but straightforward, as you say. We've been looking at the review of LASPO, and again, LASPO is one of the key concerns in the Bar Council's manifesto, The Value of Justice, which also includes much of the issues one might expect, concerns about attacks on the independence of the judiciary, the diminishing of public funding of lawyers. What else are they seeking to focus the government's attention on?
Well, quite a lot, and quite emphatically, I would say. So the Manifesto for Justice basically emphasises that all six of the core pillars of the bar are under threat, is how it puts it. And as you say, it particularly focuses on LASPO, and it makes the very valid, I would say, point that the social costs of LASPO cannot be ignored because, as it puts it, unresolved legal problems don't save government money in the long term. So 5 years after LASPO, 500,000 people no longer receive legal advice on employment, housing, welfare, family issues. And these are problems that just rankle and get worse and don't save public funds in the long term. And it also makes some, I think, important and also quite acerbic comments about the way that a society treats its most vulnerable. It makes specific reference to the huge increase in detention of immigrants in detention centres, the majority of whom, it says, will never be deported and should never have been detained in the first place. And it calls this poor decision-making by those in authority that deal with vulnerable members of society. And I think that's really interesting, and that theme comes up. It's also at pains to emphasise that justice is neither a business nor a commodity, and that we can't afford to wait for an uptick in economic prosperity to provide legal services. In fact, it says that economic prosperity depends on the rule of law. And much of this kind of echoes the sentiments in the 2015 Manifesto for Justice, but arguably in some stronger terms, and there's more emphasis perhaps on the most vulnerable. So yeah, so some interesting stuff. Also, as you said, the calls upon the government to uphold the independence of the judiciary, and I think that is particularly aimed towards the Lord Chancellor. It talks about appointing a Lord Chancellor with the requisite authority combined with experience. And I think it was a few weeks ago, but I wrote about this in the roundup before, that after the election, we might be looking at our fourth Lord Chancellor in 5 years.
Well, there's a lot to play for, isn't there? And of course, this manifesto comes out at the same time as quite a lot of gathering of interests in all sorts of other fields in view of the changes that will be entrained by Brexit. How does the bar foresee its role in post-Brexit Britain and indeed Europe?
I mean, it spells out in sort of no uncertain terms the dangers of a Brexit without a strategic plan, just kind of emphasising the need for not just a deal that takes into account the future of our legal services. It says that Brexit has the potential to damage the international market value of legal services sector, as well as, of course, undermining rights and protections for citizens and the environment, often forgotten. And some of its suggestions are pretty practical, you know, it talks about cross-border judgments and enforcement, as well as crime and policing. But it also, I think, quite interestingly, seems concerned with the vitality of the UK's reputation as a provider of legal services. It says that reputations can be won and lost, and that we need to be vigilant if we want to stay internationally competitive. So things like maintaining free movement of lawyers, avoiding protectionist measures, keeping the market open. Because as things stand now, of course, the English courts are the preeminent choice of forum for internationally contracting parties. Basically, the Bar Council has determined it will stay that way.
Just now, looking at the case law that you cover in your roundup, could you give us some background to the recent Employment Appeal Tribunal case on shift sleeping and the minimum wage, the Royal Mencap Society versus Tomlinson Blake case?
Yeah, this is kind of also an escalating row, but essentially the question is whether care workers are entitled to the national minimum wage for every hour that they do a sleep-in shift, or just for the hours that they work and not for the hours that they're asleep. Basically, the practice up until now has been that care workers have been paid a flat rate for the entire night, and usually quite a low rate, right? And then the minimum wage for the hours that they're actually dealing with something. And I think in the present case, the appellant said that it is rare that she's actually responding to an incident. It's only a few times a year. But she does have to be on the premises, keeping a listening ear, ready to respond. The Employment Appeals Tribunal ruled that she was available for work for the purposes of the minimum wage, even if she was asleep, And now, this is the crux of the issue, she and other workers like her might be owed a great deal of backdated pay. And the problem here is that the industry says it just cannot afford this. I mean, it's underfunded. This could cripple it. There's a particularly impassioned plea that I linked to in the roundup by John Kalman of MenCap, which is the learning disabilities charity in this case, and explains why they appealed the ruling. It's essentially, it's a cost issue. There are further complications. There are inconsistencies with the HMRC, who are, of course, supposed to enforce the national minimum wage. The Guardian just reported on Monday that HMRC has been advising internally that workers were not entitled to the national minimum wage while they were sleeping. So that's going on. And then there are some problems with the clarity of the judgment, which if you read, it's actually very difficult to extract the ratio of the case. The judge essentially says that there is no single decisive factor, that you need to use a multifactorial analysis, and it'll depend on the context of the case, etc. And I mean, we all know how tricky a formula that can be in practice. So for example, in this case, the fact that there's a regulatory requirement to have someone there all night was relevant, but it wasn't decisive, and so on.
It's between a rock and a hard place, really, isn't it?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's a big win for care workers, obviously.
Yes.
But it is really difficult for the industry. So
yes, and we so need carers in our increasingly aging society. The final case you cover, Sarah Jane, is all about the question of the personhood of a fetus, which is something that's long fascinated lawyers in all countries. And actually, it's recently cropped up on the UK Human Rights blog, where I posted on wrongful life claim that was defeated because a child born with congenital defects as a result of incestual rape could not be said to have had any normal life, against which to measure an appropriate award and compensation. But in your roundup, you found another aspect of this question in relation to the law on dead bodies. Could you tell us a bit about the West Yorkshire coroner's case?
Obviously, the personhood or otherwise of a fetus is a hugely important question politically. It's also really interesting when the courts have had to grapple with it, particularly so in that case in terms of damages. The argument was that although Y suffered from disabilities because his parents' relationship was incestuous and he was conceived because of rape, the court couldn't quite accept that that was an injury, partly because injury presupposes a pre-injury state, as you put it in your blog, but partly also because without this crime, Y wouldn't exist at all. So their existence couldn't be seen as an injury. And I thought it was quite interesting to compare this to cases in the civil stream. So for example, Rees and Darlington NHS Memorial Trust, where a woman conceived after a negligently performed sterilisation and tried to claim damages. And in that case, the injuria or the harm that she was claiming for was a child and the cost of raising a child. And the court tends to find that conceptually quite difficult to stomach. So those are some interesting cases. But yeah, the difficulty here in the West Yorkshire coroner's case was more procedural than financial. I'd recommend you look at David Hart's analysis. As he says, coroner's duties arise in respect of the body of a deceased person, as per the Coroners and Justice Act 2009. So basically the mother in this case was a 19-year-old woman who'd walked into hospital with the body of a tiny baby in a shoebox, and she tried to argue that the coroner had no jurisdiction because the baby was stillborn and therefore was never a deceased person. And this is a concept that's familiar to the criminal law. So you have a whole host of early cases establishing at what point a fetus becomes a person in being for the purposes of homicide, whether it has to have left the mother's body or have an independent existence, but you don't need to have cut the umbilical cord, all these kinds of really detailed nitty-gritty questions. In the present case, the mother's argument failed when she said that the coroner couldn't have jurisdiction because the baby had never had legal personhood in order to be deceased, if that makes sense. But the court held that wouldn't hold because it would lead to an illogical conclusion. It would mean that the coroner had to decide on incomplete evidence whether or not the child was born alive. And that can't be a preliminary issue, but one specifically under the coroner's jurisdiction in the public interest to determine whether this was a live birth or a stillbirth. So yeah, really, really interesting case, this.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.